subscribe to our free podcasts at abc.net.au/rn.
Well, hello, and welcome to Life Matters. I'm Cassie McCullough, with you all this week while Natasha Mitchell is on leave. She had an unexpected appendectomy yesterday, but listeners need not fear, she's doing very well. In fact, if you drop by the Life Matters Facebook page, you'll see that she's posted an article from the Scientific American on the function of the appendix. Ever the scientist, Natasha Mitchell. So this morning, do stick around, because a little later we're going to be talking about Arabs and their dogs, once held at a distance. Traditions are changing with new generations, and furry friends are making their way into the hearts and homes of many varied communities. That's the third part in our Crossroads series. Also, life in an elite rural boarding school. For one 14-year-old girl, it was a hell of bullying, hazing and loneliness. Now, at the age of 30, Rebecca Stafford has written about her experiences. She says they continue to haunt her for years and have coloured her adult relationships. That's ahead on Life Matters. But first, money, twins and your bank account. Are you a saver or a spender? Would you believe the answer might belong in your genetic makeup? Recent research published in the Journal of Political Economy shows that your propensity to manage money is, to a significant degree, shaped by your genes. A pair of researchers between Shanghai and Seattle have delved into the individual wealth of fraternal and identical twins and have made some intriguing discoveries. And their findings are particularly relevant to us as we become increasingly responsible for savings throughout our lives to fund retirement. It's a big priority, especially as apparently we're going to be living until we're 150. Stefan Segal is Associate Professor of Finance and Business Economics at the University of Washington Business School. G'day, Stefan.
Good morning.
I was a little bit nervous then because I thought I was going to accidentally say Steven Segal. I'm sure you've been called that before. Stefan Segal. Now, tell us, you're looking at human behaviour around financial decisions, particularly saving and risk-taking. Now, what are the kind of determinants that influence us? There's many of them apart from genes. What are they?
Yeah, there are basically two sets that we try to distinguish. On the one hand, there is the biological domain that is mainly genetic, and then there is a large environmental domain that is made up out of a lot of different contributors that basically a person accumulates over the course of their life. There is not one single one out of these environmental factors that seems to matter a whole lot, but a lot of small factors taken together seem to account for about two-thirds of the differences that we observe in many financial behaviors, including saving behaviors, across people, with one-third being basically predetermined, if you wish, by a person's genetic makeup.
So the other ones, before we get to the genetic determinants, they're what, age?
Of course. There are life cycle effects, right, where people save largely for retirement. So if you wish to separate those that are sort of still in their productive lives, in the sense of having sort of work income, they save from that. And then later in life, people basically dissave from their savings to finance consumption in retirement. So that's one really big difference over the life cycle related to age. And then, of course, it also depends on people's background risk. As economists would say, those that have a higher propensity, for example, to lose their job will typically save more than those that are in very safe jobs where sort of unexpected shortfall income is much less likely. Those things all matter as they should and as economists had predicted. They just don't matter a whole lot, every single one of them, when we think about differences across people.
So why turn to genetics for the answer?
Oh yeah, that's an excellent question, and it's actually one that hadn't been asked for a long time. I think people had observed that there's a lot of persistence with respect to patients in particular, and we think sort of the underlying psychological construct is essentially how patient someone is that drives their savings behavior. And work by Walter Mischel in the 1980s basically documented that sort of patience of a four-year-old is highly predictive of outcomes later in life with respect to college entry exams, obesity, and marital status. And people were wondering how come that there is so much persistence. And at the same time, economists had documented that children are similar with respect to savings decisions, similar to their parents. And so the dominant view actually was for a long time that it was likely parents that instilled in their children certain attitudes, for example, the attitude of patience and foregoing immediate rewards for bigger rewards later in life. And that was sort of the dominant, I think, view for a long time. And at some point, we started realizing there is an alternative that could explain very much these patterns of persistence within a person, as well as correlation between parents and their children, and that would be basically a biological route where parents passed on their genes to their children that on the one hand gave the persistence or stability within the person, but also connected people across generations.
Okay,
and,
so how do
the
you
difference basically matters. So that's why we started looking into genetics as an alternative.
So how do you test patience in a four-year-old? Is this some kind of self-control or ability for delayed gratification?
Right. That's exactly right. So Walter Mischel conducted this famous marshmallow experiment where he basically gave a four-year-old a choice between eating a marshmallow that was placed in front of the kid right away or waiting a little bit until the experimenter came back and basically offered the child two marshmallows in reward of having waited for the return of the experimenter. And they basically just basically measured which choice the children made, and then they actually waited themselves for about 14 years until these children had turned 18, and they correlated this early decision with college entry exams, and then they actually continued following this very same group of people into their 40s, and people have even detected that there were differences in their brain structure at age 40 that were predicted by the choice that they made at age 4.
Well, look, I'm nodding here. I've always thought marshmallows were particularly evil, and you're explaining a lot there for me. But now tell us, Stefan Sigal, about these how this relates to twins, because you and your research partner turned to the Swedish Twin Registry, which is the world's largest, and you've delved into the catalogue of tax filings. Now, that must have been a lot of fun. But tell us, what is the Swedish Twins Registry, and what did the process involve?
Yeah, so so Sweden basically has, as you said, the world's largest registry of twins, because in Sweden, essentially every twin birth is reported via the health system to a registry placed in Stockholm, and therefore the registry knows about every twin birth and also knows whether or not these twins were identical or fraternal twins. They have built over time a huge inventory of essentially all twins in Sweden. They then follow up with these twins in a number of surveys to collect additional data points. And in addition to that, Sweden until 2007 had a wealth tax that every taxpayer in Sweden needed to pay. And in order to do so fairly, Sweden collected extremely detailed records on people's financial assets as well as liabilities. And to our surprise, we basically asked essentially Statistics Sweden, the central government body that collects all these data points, whether or not they would agree to match their data on people's tax records with data on their, basically, whether or not they were identical or fraternal twins. And to our surprise, they agreed. And then that actually turned out that sort of similar things have been done before in Sweden. And so we were basically able to measure for a large number of twins what their financial decision looked like. and could then exploit basically the correlation between identical twins with respect to savings decisions versus the correlation between fraternal twins. And by showing that identical twins behave more similarly relative to fraternal twins, we basically find evidence that the higher genetic similarity for the identical twins relative to the fraternal twins seems to drive that correlation.
So we should just be clear, you're not saying that identical twins are much better at saving or worse, they're just more similar to each other.
That's exactly right. So our entire study is not about the level of savings at all. It's really just about the sources of the variation. And in this particular context, what we find is that the correlation between identical twins is about 30% versus the correlation between fraternal twins, which are just like regular siblings in terms of their genetic relatedness, is about 15%. So identical twins that are genetically identical behave sort of twice as similarly, if you wish, relative to regular siblings or fraternal twins.
So is that a large amount, is it? Is 30% enough to really significantly influence behaviour?
So I think that's a very good question. It for sure says that it is a substantial amount. It's one-third, if you wish, ultimately, of the cross-sectional variation that is due to genetic similarity. But it also says that there is two-thirds that are other things, and these are the environmental factors that I mentioned earlier that sort of as a group clearly matter much more. People had looked at a large number of these factors individually and had typically found that they individually matter relatively little. I think it depends on which level one would like to make the comparison. If we compare genetics versus any individual factor, genes are very important. If we compare the collection of individual factors relative to genes, those are more important.
We're talking with Stefan Siegel. He's Associate Professor of Finance and Business Economics at the University of Washington Business School. So what's the kind of outcome for you of this? So you're going to use this how will you use this information?
Okay, very, very, very good, yeah. So I think one really important implication is when we think about ultimately the outcome of all the savings activity and the investment activity people undertake during their lives, it basically is all reflected, if you wish, in their wealth at some point in their life. And we actually look at the distribution of wealth for those that are between age 60 and 70, just to fix a point in time relative to their life. And one can then basically ask, where does variation in wealth come from, right? Where does inequality come from? And basically the results on the savings dimension, as well as other results with respect to how people invest or how people basically generate income, all basically suggest that there ought to be a big sort of relatively big genetic component. And indeed, when we decompose the differences in wealth, so basically think about the inequality in society with respect to wealth, we do find again that about 40% of that difference across people is due to their genetic makeup, whereas the rest again is due to environmental things. Interestingly, only about 10%, actually slightly less even, of the differences are due to sort of other things that people get from their parents. And this, of course, importantly includes sort of any type of inheritance, monetary inheritance, right? So basically what this tells us is that a good part, 40% of the differences in the wealth distribution, is determined by the genetic endowments that children receive or people receive from their parents, and only 10% is actually due to sort of the financial assets being handed down. And I think that has a sort of a big implication when we think about the sources of inequality, right? So the inequality, at least in the Swedish society in the early 2000s, seems to stem much more from sort of the biological inheritance that their parents give to their children rather than financial assets or so on that their children would also receive.
So the more,
and I think that shifts a little bit how we think about, on the one hand, what the sources are, but also, of course, how we should maybe address differences.
So the more we know about our behaviour, the more we can trace it to learned behaviour and perhaps genetic, we can change what we do and maybe even educate future generations about different ways to plan their futures. Thank you so much for explaining this to us, Stefan.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Stefan Sigul is Associate Professor of Finance and Business Economics at the University of Washington Business School. And we'll put some links to that research on the Life Matters homepage. Fascinating stuff. Coming up, we're going to be talking to a woman who had an awful experience in boarding school at 14, one that she thinks has coloured her whole life.
Hi, it's Patricia Carvelis from RN Drive, where we ask the hard-hitting questions. I wanted to involve emojis in this interview, Julie Bishop, but I haven't figured out how. what emoji would you use for this interview? That's RN Drive, putting the sound to your emoji.
Well, I think I've got a smiley face.
Oh, good. Tonight at 6.
Yes, dogs. They're well loved in Western culture, but not necessarily in others. And we'll be looking at the way our relationship with dogs, and particularly in the Australian Arrow community, is changing a little bit later on. It's the third in the Crossroads series we've been hearing on Life Matters. We'll meet some new devotees to the domestic hound. But first, were you bullied at school? Or were you the bully, perhaps? Perhaps you might have just observed and not acted, colluding with the bullies by your reticence to speak out. As a 14-year-old, Rebecca Stafford, who's the founding editor of the Kill Your Darlings literary magazine and one-time deputy editor of the Australian Book Review, won a scholarship to a prestigious school. It had a campus in the bushland of the Victorian High Country where Year 9s had to spend a compulsory year as boarders. It was there at night when the teachers left the students to themselves that Rebecca witnessed, participated in, and suffered from the severe bullying that unsupervised teenaged girls can dish out to each other. Well, Rebecca has written a memoir focusing on those years. It's called Bad Behaviour. And I should point out that she's changed the names and identifying characteristics of the school and the pupils, but the story is a real one. Rebecca joins us now from our Melbourne studios. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks, Cassie.
Now, your book starts with a description of a shocking event, which sets the tone for your memoir and one that really still haunts you. We'll get to that. But first, tell us about the school and why they think it's a good idea to put Year 9 students, legendarily kind of animals, really, together in the bush for a year.
Yeah, Year 9, it's a pretty tricky age, I think. So the campus that I attended, like you described in your introduction, is a remote rural campus in the bush, about 3 hours from Melbourne. And here I lived with 15 other girls in a wooden house. In the book, it's called Red House. And it was a really Spartan environment. We didn't have any of the creature comforts we enjoy now. There was no heating or cooling. There was no we didn't have laptops or internet or television. There weren't any phones at all, actually, on the campus to communicate with friends or family. Back at home, we had to write letters. As well as the regular school program for that year, we also participated in a really rigorous outdoor education program, which included cross-country running most evenings after school, as well as hiking on weekends and other outdoor pursuits like Rogaining and skiing in the summer. Sorry, the winter
Rogaining?
Times as well.
Rogaining?
Rogaining, which is the kind, if I'm remembering correctly, where you compete in teams for tags, which are sort of set around the bush. So whole days spent out basically on one big race. So yeah, it was a really intense program, physically and emotionally. And I mean, I do believe that the principles that that govern this program are really well intentioned to foster within the students at this really kind of crucial and formative age a sense of self-confidence and self-reliance and also a belief in yourself, because, you know, you do spend so much time on your own and with your peers, whether it's, you know, up in the unit or whether it's out in the bush on your own in the middle of nowhere, and you need to get from A to B on your hikes, and no one's holding your hand along the way, and often pushing yourselves to the limits of your, you know, physical boundaries. I mean, that was really something that I've taken with me through to being an adult.
So some positives. Now, just for the listener, how long ago was this? You were writing about when you were 14 years old, when you arrived at this bush camp. Yep. You're now 30, so about 15 yes. years ago. It's not the yes. long, dark, distant past. This is fairly recent.
It is fairly recent, but when I was writing about myself, the book split into two parts, or two voices really, my 14-year-old self and then my more contemporary adult self. And writing about myself as a teenager did feel like a long time ago in some ways, and then writing about myself in an adult, which presented all kinds of challenges, but I do feel that distance of time. I know it's not very long in the scheme of things, but it does seem like a long time ago in many ways.
Yeah, I guess I raise it only in the context of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, which that's not exactly what we're talking about here, but many of those are historical, although there are some very recent ones as well. And so it is only a decade and a half ago that we're talking about. Now, how did you end up going to this school? What was your path there?
Well, I won a scholarship to the school when I was 10 or 11 years old, and I went to the Melbourne campus, and then in this particular year, as you mentioned, it's a compulsory year away, and so that was my entry point into the school. So it was actually a place that I'd always dreamed of going to. You know, I really wanted to participate in this year out in the bush. I was really looking forward to it, but when I sort of landed there on the first day after my mum dropped me off, I was terrified. I don't think I really understood, you know, what I'd got myself into.
And who or what were you terrified of?
I think it was a sense, you know, fundamentally a fear of not fitting in, which I think is what most boys and girls of that age feel. I hadn't been to boarding school before. Many of the girls in the unit already had. They were accustomed to this program, and they're experienced in the nuances of you know, daily life, and also how to interact with girls that you spend essentially every day and every hour and every minute together with. So I really felt, you know, a pressure within myself to fit in. And of course, as I go on to write about in the book, that initially pushed me into the path, and I found myself drawn to figures of power within the unit. I wanted to be liked. I wanted to be popular. And of course, that really pushed me into a group of girls who you know, were a dominant force in the house.
Yeah, I think we can all picture the tough girls in any school environment. And we should point out that there's several different houses at this boarding school, and you were just in one of them. And not all the other houses appeared to have this really dysfunctional, well, psychodrama playing out inside it.
No, I mean, certainly not that I'm aware of. I think each house would carry its own complexity. But I think what was unusual to my particular house was that it was a mix of girls that became somewhat toxic, you know, as the year progressed. We had very powerful dominant figures, and also a group of more vulnerable girls. And that became something, especially when we were left on our own, that became really, really problematic. And of course, you know, it became a bit of a Lord of the Flies situation where we had to self-regulate our own behaviour, and we didn't do that very well.
Let's talk about well, Portia and Ronnie and Kendall. Portia was the top dog, I guess. I'm instantly using the language of prisoner to describe this, and I shouldn't be smiling when I'm saying that. It was really very traumatic, some of the treatment she dished out to you and others.
Yeah, I suppose essentially she's the most powerful figure within the book and within my memories of that year. And so she was someone that I did immediately want to align myself with. I'd identified her power quite clearly. But I mean, the thing about female friendship, and this is what I've found when I've been writing it, is I think it's very difficult to talk about bullying, particularly within girls' cliques and girls' friendship, without talking about the intimacy of the friendship at the same time. So, I mean, it's very common, I think, for girls to become, you know, to form very intense friendships, as I had with Portia and other girls within this particular group. And so often the aggression that we experience actually forms within the intensity of this friendship group itself. So, I mean, we became very close for a period of time, and then, of course, inevitably I fell out of favour and became, I suppose, an object of her kind of bullying intentions, not to the extremity that Kendall suffered or other girls within the house, but of course I felt really rejected and afraid again and uncertain. And I guess once I was outside of that group and within the book particularly, I observe, I think, more clearly and more objectively the dynamics of the bullying within the house.
And what you do describe very eloquently is that awful ease with which we begin to side with the bully if we think it might help our outcomes. And there's another girl who you call Emma, who was probably, I guess, more of a country girl, the others being privileged and also from the city. And she says to you at one stage, why are you being mean? Why are you joining in with this? All the other girls think you're great and you're being, you know, you're joining in with the bullies. How did you sort of find yourself in that place?
Oh, look, it's a really good question. I think, you know, I think something within me sort of changed in that year. I was away from home for the first time. I'd always been very well behaved as well. I mean, you know, I was a scholarship student. I was pretty, you know, I'd been a good girl up until that point. And I think, you know, feeling this sense of freedom also unleashed something, you know, more unpleasant within me, particularly, related to how I wanted to fit in and how I wanted to feel my own sense of power, because of course that's what's driving it. It's a desire to feel powerful and also to be loved, with, you know, even if that's through a kind of terror at the same time. But I mean, this particular friend Emma is the voice of reason, I suppose, throughout the book. She is a bit of a moral compass, and I cared about her deeply, but at times, you know, I would push aside our friendship in order to curry favour with the other girls as well, which is something that, you know, I felt deeply, deeply ashamed of as I reflected on later as an adult.
I think everybody can remember a time when they've done exactly the same thing. We're talking with Rebecca Stafford. She's the author of a book called Bad Behaviour, which is a memoir of her time in a boarding school in rural Victoria, where basically the girls, Year 9 girls, were left to, well, as Rebecca says, it was a kind of Lord of the Flies environment. They were left to govern themselves at night time. Now, I want to hear about the way that you feel this has affected your later life and your ability to form healthy relationships. But just tell us, before we leave the school time, about what happened to Kendall.
Well, Kendall was a girl who I actually went on to be in the same house with down at the senior school. And she was someone, I wouldn't say that we ever became friends, but we were certainly, you know, I developed a deep respect for her courage and for her resilience. And I can remember in our final year, we used to walk to and from an English class together that we shared. And we'd have really long, interesting chats about all kinds of things that were going on in the world. But we never talked about the Silver Creek year once. which I think we were both thankful for at that time. But whenever I think of her now, I think about her courage and her strength.
And one particular incident.
Well, I mean, you know, there were quite a few instances, unfortunately, where Kendall, you know, was the victim of the bullying within the house. So I'm not sure which one in particular.
Oh, I mean the
particular
one that you opened the book with
her. Oh, okay, sure. Yes, well, I mean, okay, so the opening, the prologue opens with a scene which actually happens in the middle of the year. So there'd been a lot of taunting and a lot of build-up to this moment. I think that the seriousness of the scene, I think the drama of the opening, you know, slightly exaggerates maybe the overall seriousness of it. But Kendall, I think, had become frustrated and just totally sick of the situation, and she got up in a moment of you know, in a strange performance, I suppose, in a way that was saying, stop, I've had enough of this. And she picked up her impulse, which we all had back then.
A spray can of impulse.
And it was, I think, an act of just saying, I've had enough of this, you know, and look at me, for who I am. I'm a person and all of that kind of thing. And it was, she sprayed up and down her jeans and took a lighter and lit the jeans. I mean, she wasn't injured in any way. But it was this sort of horrible, you know, this is in the middle of the night, the dawn was completely dark, and it was just this sort of scene of blue flames pulsing up and down her. And we were all horrified, because I think at that point we just realised how far she had been pushed. Everyone had been pushed to their limits during that year, but, you know, she had really hit a wall, I think, at that time. And that was really kind of scary for all of us. But she wasn't injured in any way. It was just a moment where she was saying, enough, you know, this has to stop. So it was
a moment of absolute extremity. And you do describe so many of them in your book. In subsequent years, you talk about going through therapy and talking through these incidents, but it was really going back and looking at your journals and even standing in the places where things had happened before you could sort of let them go, but also see how they'd formed and shaped you. Tell us about how you feel they've changed your relationships.
Well, I first decided to write about these experiences about 4 or 5 years ago. I found myself in an unhappy place. I'd just come out of a fairly dysfunctional relationship. I'd fallen out with a few of my close friends, and I was finding it difficult to connect to people. I mean, on the outside, I think, you know, life seemed okay, but on the inside, I knew that something wasn't right with me, and I didn't quite know how to talk about it to other people, and I didn't really understand my own feelings and my own behaviour.
So distrust?
I think there was not so much distrusting other people. I think I felt a great sense of, I carried around a lot of shame. As I talk about in the book, you know, I'm a young gay woman and I came out in my early 20s, but that wasn't an easy transition for me, an easy acceptance for a variety of reasons. But I carried around, I think, a lot of shame. And so that was a process of trying to kind of pick apart where, you know, how I had come to this point. And to do that, I realized I had to go back because I found that the romantic relationships I had been forming had been similar in their dynamics and in their nature to these friendships.
So you were seeking out powerful but destructive people?
I think ultimately, yes. I mean, you know, not in every aspect of my life, but there was certainly a pattern there. And when I recognised that pattern, it was quite confronting. But also, you know, it offered me a few answers. So I decided I wanted to go back and explore this year away a little further because I hadn't actually really thought about it, which seems strange. I just sort of relegated it.
I think that's a common tactic that people use. Rebecca, tell us what you'd say to the 14-year-old Rebecca in similar circumstances.
Now. Oh, wow. So many things. Look, I think I wouldn't be so hard on myself, and I would also ask, you know, I'd encourage her to trust her instincts about, you know, particular behaviour, because ultimately, you know, I was aware of the things I was doing were wrong, but I didn't have the strength to kind of, you know, stand up for those convictions, which is much easier said than done when you're living, you know, in a very claustrophobic environment with 14 other, you know, 15 other girls. But I think understanding myself a little bit better, which has been one of the great aspects of writing the book, you know, it's almost like I didn't know this girl, and then I've gone back and I've got to know her so much better, and also learn to love her. So that's been a really wonderful experience for me during the process of writing the book.
I know that your family haven't read the book. What responses have you had from other people about it?
It's been really positive so far. I mean, I think what's been really interesting talking about bullying and aggression is that when I talk to women readers particularly, and also to men, is most people can identify with this experience. I mean, obviously mine was particularly magnified, you know, because of this unique setting. But I think, you know, we all know what it feels like, whether it's we've been bullied or we've been the bully, because we've all had these kinds of friendships during our life. So I think for me, I you know, somewhat naively thought that my experience was totally unique and no one else would really understand or identify with it. But, you know, it's really started an interesting discussion about the nature of female friendship, which I think is really important when we talk about bullying.
Mm. Well, it's a very brave discussion that you've started, and it's a very brave memoir, beautifully written as well. Thank you for sharing some of it with us today, Rebecca.
Thanks very much for having me.
Rebecca Stanford, she's the author of Bad Behaviour, a memoir of bullying and boarding school. It's published by Allen and Unwin. I'm Cassie McCullough. I'm sitting in for Natasha Mitchell this week. Coming up next, reimagining the relationship between Arab migrants and their dogs.
The ABC Radio mobile app has always been very good at now. But now the updated version is also packed full of RN podcasts. So now it's also very good at the later. Listen live to RN programs right now, or catch up with your favourite RN shows later. The ABC Radio mobile app. Download it from your smartphone's app market or abc.net.au/radio.
And now on Life Matters to the third episode of Crossroads, a series about everyday life in Australia's North African and Middle Eastern communities. I've been loving this series, and this one in particular, I like, it's about dogs. Now, it's a common belief that Muslim and Arab communities don't relate well to dogs, that they're fearful or repulsed by the dog. So how strong are the taboos about dogs, and are attitudes changing? Here's Nadiat El-Ghouli.
Wombat.
Hello and welcome to Crossroads. I'm Nadiat El-Ghouli here on RN.
High five. Good girl.
Today, dogs and our complex relationship with them. Over two-thirds of us have pets and most of us have a dog. But not all communities have embraced the dog. Traditionally, many Arab communities didn't keep dogs as house pets, though things are changing. More and more Australian Arabs now own dogs as pets and are enjoying their companionship. And you might say this shift is being led by the second generation.
A girl and a dog kicking along to the park where they go every day. She's what she's not, they go together nicely. He's a sensitive soul, short, dark and handsome. Always knows what not to say. Loves her completely, puts a little dance on when she gets home at the end of the day. A girl and a dog.
Poet and performer Candy Royale grew up with dogs, and although her parents' attitude initially was to keep a distance between the dog and the family, things changed after a Belgian shepherd called Bear came into their lives.
The first dog we really had was, her name was Bonnie, and she was a bit of a mutt. I don't know what she was exactly, but I had a very close relationship with her and used to go on adventures with her and was very affectionate to her. But to my parents, she was always to be in her doghouse and, you know, she wasn't to come up to the house. And then when we had our other dog, Bear, who was a Belgian shepherd, and she was around for like 14 years, my brother and I were really, really close to her because we essentially grew up with her. She was kind of like almost the matriarch of the family, to be honest, and really regal and beautiful and intuitive. And I think that she broke my parents. I think that she kind of got through to their hearts a little bit, to be honest. So whilst in the beginning it was just my brother and I giving lots of love and feeling that Bear and Bonnie were like our friends, eventually that came to be the case for my mum and dad too, with Bear. My mum just started to realise that dogs are very intelligent and that they're very emotional, and she could see that, you know, they weren't just this thing to have around in the backyard to protect us or whatever. She, you know, Bear became part of the family, definitely. And then my dad soon followed suit, I think, especially with their new dog, Baron. When I take my dog up to visit, she's a house dog, a wombat, so she has to be in the house. She's a small dog. She doesn't have to be, but it's a strange thing to her to be kept outside. She doesn't understand why she's outside and everyone's inside. And they just let her inside and she's allowed to just roam around like normal. And that would never have happened 10 years ago. Like, not in a million years. I would have had to chain her up outside. But now they're much more comfortable.
Candy Royale. Shadia Farage is 19 and comes from a bicultural family. Her mother is Chilean and her father Lebanese. Shadia hasn't grown up with dogs because of family restrictions, but it hasn't stopped her from having a strong affection for them. Recently, she was on a student placement at the Addison Road Community Centre in Sydney's Inner West. The centre is located on the historical site of the old army barracks in Marrickville. The organisation now hosts many community groups, including the animal rescue service, Maggie's Rescue. And the centre has a dog-friendly workplace policy. It was something Shadia hadn't expected.
Well, my first day here was it was amazing. There was dogs running around everywhere, and I've been deprived of pets since I was a child. I've never had a dog or anything like that, and it just came naturally. Like, our boss, Rosanna, has a pet called Mimi, a dog, and we call her the Addison Road dog because she's part of the Addison Road family now, but she's so playful and she's such a princess, and sometimes she can be snobby, you know. She's got the same personalities as a person, but I love her.
Well, there's a stereotype about the relationship between Arabs and dogs, and that is that Arabs don't like dogs. They're either scared of them or repulsed by them, and they don't keep them as pets. In your opinion, is that true?
To be honest with you, it all depends on the person. From my understanding, there are people who are Arab who are afraid of dogs and don't like dogs at all, who run away at the sight of dogs. But then there are also, you know, Europeans that run away from the sight of dogs. So it's more based on the individual and how they've grown accustomed to having a dog or not having a dog. I don't think it's mostly Arabs. It can be anyone from any culture who's more afraid of dogs, because I'm Arab. I've never had a dog. I've had pet fish and that's about it. And I just have a connection with dogs and I'll play with them anytime I want.
I don't know. I had lots of Italian and Greek friends when I was growing up, and their families were exactly the same. It was, when I was young, quite unusual for us Lebanese and Greeks and Italians to have dogs at all. I think I don't think it's unique to Arabs, but I think that it's across a few cultures.
You're on RN with me, Nadia Telgorli, and Crossroads, a series exploring communities in change.
Yeah, good girl.
Samia says its childhood was filled with the dogs her parents adopted to guard the house. The dogs weren't allowed inside, but as a child, Samia formed a strong bond with one of them.
Where did they go?
One of the dogs, Sheba, that my parents adopted was one of the ones that we spent the most time with. She was a bit of a trouble dog in terms of, like, she was a bit fearful of humans, wouldn't really interact that well with other dogs, highly energetic. She was a Rottweiler cross. Maybe had a little bit of fear aggression.
but loved me and my younger brother, like absolutely adored us, and would try and escape as soon as we went to school, would follow the car. So we were quite young kids, and she was totally cool with us and absolutely adored us, and we used to run around the backyard with her all every single day.
So when you were growing up and you had dogs, would that have set you apart from the rest of the Arabic community?
Yes and no. Some of my family had dogs as well for the same purpose as guard dogs. It was a little bit funny, like as soon as we had family coming over, dogs were out of sight. I mean, they weren't generally allowed inside anyway, but it was like quite strict that they weren't allowed in. And people would make comments as in like, oh my God, ew, a dog, you know, just because of the cleanliness or the purity of it. I grew up in a Muslim family, and my mum's religious, dad isn't. Mum prays 5 times a day. So in order to pray, you have to be clean, which is pure. So prior to praying, they either have to have a shower. There's a particular word for it, it's called tatwadda. You know, in order to pray, you have to be pure. And a dog breaks that purity. I don't exactly know why. Maybe because they're outdoor animals. And if a dog's hair touches you whilst you're pure, you become impure and you have to clean again. So tatwadda there again.
Samia Sayed. For Muslim Arabs, having a dog can bring you into conflict with religious teaching. Most Islamic scholars agree people can keep dogs only under certain circumstances, as guard dogs, hunting dogs, or assistance animals. But there's a growing international conversation that's challenging that view. In Malaysia, social justice activists are tackling taboos around dogs and speaking up for animals. Online publications such as the Huffington Post and the Arab American News have been featuring stories on dog ownership and the points of view of their Arab and Muslim owners. And a Facebook page called Good Muslims Love Dogs has attracted poetry, stories and discussion about kindness and the human-animal bond. Shadia says in her experience, Arab families are responding more positively to dogs.
You know, now it's a little bit modernised, so there would be a lot of Arab families that do have dogs as pets. But before, when my dad was living in Lebanon, he didn't really, you know, pay attention to dogs. He didn't want a dog because religiously it's just their saliva is dirty and we're not allowed to touch dirty things and be dirty because we need to pray and stay clean for God. That's what his belief is.
So do you think that you can balance your commitment to your faith and your love of dogs?
Yeah, I've been doing a pretty good job of it right now. You know, I've been praying. I do everything that I'm supposed to do. It's just that little tiny thing that, you know, I'm not really disgusted or I don't really believe that a dog's saliva can be dirty. That's just the little thing that I don't worry about because I love dogs and I like playing with them and they're fun to have around.
I knew I didn't want to grow up, wasn't eager to drink or explore sex, just wanted to climb trees with my dog. Her name was Bonnie, she climbed trees and barked at rocks.
This is Candy with When I Was Young, a song from her recent production, Frida People. Candy was diagnosed with ovarian cancer early in 2014. Her treatment was an intense experience of operations and chemotherapy. She continued to work, produce poetry and sing. And all along the way, her dog, Wombat, was there.
When I was recently diagnosed with cancer, having her there constantly was a really great comfort to me, you know, and I think that's what dogs provide. They provide such companionship and comfort. Even though I was surrounded by friends and family and stuff, it's just she sleeps at the foot of my bed and having that body there, and you know, it's a comfort to have her, and she's, you know, one of my best friends.
Samia also works at the Addison Road Community Centre at Reverse Garbage, a recycling and art organisation based there. And about 2 years ago, at a seniors community event, Samia met Little Kim, an older Staffy Cross the RSPCA had brought along that day. It set in motion some momentous changes in her family.
So when I first got Little Kim, I introduced her to my family. And my mum instantly loved her, was like, what is this dog? She's so obedient. She follows you everywhere you go. She sits when you tell her to sit. How do I get one like her? And I was like, well, you've got to go to, you know, get a rescue dog, but you've got to train them. She's like, can I have a little Kim? I'm like, nah, you can't. She's mine. You can borrow her, but you can't have her. They used my brother's birthday as an excuse to get him a dog. They got Angus, another pit bull, who is also the sweetest thing. I feel like the transformation, they kind of saw this when a dog is, and I hate to say it, but when a dog kind of listens to you or is obedient in any way, I felt like they saw positives to that and were like, oh, this is a good companionship. And I feel like transforming from that a dog as a guard to a dog as a friend.
When I was growing up, I said that none of my cousins had dogs, but now a lot of them do, or, you know, they have been over the years. So I definitely think that there's a change happening, yeah.
And what do you think accounts for this change in attitude?
The normalization of having a dog around and seeing the joy that dogs bring to kids and seeing there's no need to be afraid and that dogs aren't actually dirty. Dogs are such a part of Australian culture, and I think that, again, that's a normalisation of something that perhaps in the homeland isn't so, you know, normal. I think we can learn a lot from dogs and their ability to love, you know. They require so little of anything, you know, some food and love and water, that's it, you know, and they give back so much love as well, so... Yeah, I can't imagine not having a dog in my life.
Yeah, you dog. I grab Mimi and I play with her hands and I pretend she's like a boxer and a rapper at one point. And she has this little hoodie jumper and we're filming her, you know, rapping along to music. They're just too cute. They're like babies.
Harry Nilsson with the puppy song, and before that, Shadai, Candy and Samia on having dogs and some of the changing attitudes towards them in the Arab community. Thanks to Nadiat El-Ghorli and sound engineer Lila Shunner. And if you want to check that story out again or recommend it to a friend, you'll find it on the Life Matters homepage. I'm Cassie McCullough. I'm filling in today and all this week for Natasha Mitchell. Now, last week, Life Matters was looking at some changes to welfare support. How the degree of disability will affect income. Here's a couple of your responses.
We shouldn't forget that even when disabled people are working, their hourly payments are varied according to their abilities, the most disabled being those whose hourly payments are most reduced. I even heard of somebody who was only getting $1 an hour. The other thing I'd like to say is that no individuals, they say, registered at present will be worse off. Registered at present, what about those who are not yet registered? Will they be worse off as well? But there's a series of words that have to be examined there. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm on the Disability Support Pension, and I just wanted to say that the way it's been the last few years, we've had months and months and months of anxiety, worrying about what changes are going to come in and how they're going to affect us. And you either feel relieved but then guilty if it doesn't affect you. And can I say that it doesn't help us to encourage us to go back to work. It discourages you to try because you know that if you actually make it into a job but you can't stay there, if it doesn't work out, then you're going to have too much difficulty getting back on the pension even though you actually need it. Thanks.
Just a couple of calls there. Now, if you'd like to leave a message for any of the stories, about any of the stories we've been talking about today or over any time, why not leave one at 02 833 1430. That's 02 833 1430. Now, Coming up on Books and Arts, Michael Cathcart is going to be talking to Elizabeth Gilbert. We all know her as the author of Eat, Pray, Love. She's got a new book, The Signature of All Things. It's from the Perth Festival, this conversation. Apparently, Michael Cathcart had a fantastic time.